Get all the MasterForce outdoor power equipment you need to maintain your yard at Menards. Own the outdoors with MasterForce 80-volt power equipment, delivering all the power of gas without the maintenance. The entire 80-volt line is powered by brushless motors for ultimate performance and productivity. From lawnmowers to leaf blowers, string trimmers, and more, find everything you need to create the lawn of your dreams with MasterForce power equipment at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Welcome to the podcast, everybody. Here we go. Shall you start or shall I?
Go for it.
Okay. I'm reading these for the first time in several days. So
I have no idea what I've got written down.
All right. Oh, I was listening to the Young Turks. They popped up on my YouTube.
Okay.
And the background is that they, you know, it's funny, the levels of commentary here. They were commenting on an article in The Guardian.
Let's comment on their commentary.
Let's comment on their commentary. It's like the Bo Burnham skit. Where the ultra wealthy are miserable, and it talks like this person works with them and talks about how there's a lot of vying for money with family. You can't trust anybody. The kids often never really have a sense of achievement if they're from generational wealth because they're never asked to do anything, and it creates tons of issues.
I've seen this. I know multiple people whose families just fight all the time because they're desperately clawing at the money of dead relatives.
Yeah. And the one guy, Cenk, expressed some empathy, but I thought this line from, I think her name is Anna Kasparian, was just like instructive and interesting to discuss, was, "I feel zero empathy for them. Do you feel your friends aren't genuine? Cry me a goddamn river. Are you living in a cardboard box on the sidewalk? Do you feel like you don't have purpose? Go find purpose, bitch. You have endless resources." And I thought it was interesting because, like, the same pull yourself up by your bootstraps, I would succeed in your situation mentality that she has is exactly what she hates in Republicans. And she would, if she were sitting here, she would argue, and I agree to an extent, that material circumstances can be very difficult to overcome. But of course, she has no idea, no concept, and as she expressed, zero empathy for what it would be like to live in someone else's shoes. And if it is the case that so many wealthy people struggle so much to be happy, is that not a material circumstance causing, like, that is having a massive influence over
that? They struggle to really get the predictable patterns that come with what they think they want. So, like, when children get famous, it's just almost always a death sentence for their mental health.
Really bad thing for kids.
And people have no empathy when, like, Justin Bieber is speeding through a neighborhood because he's reckless. He's this. That's, like, this kid was doomed the second he got famous. And you can see it playing out in the fact that his health has not been good. His mental health has not been good. But nobody feels bad for him in the same way that...
Because he has the things that they think would improve their lives.
Right. Versus there's other things that are predictable. Like, if you have an alcoholic abusive dad, that's going to fuck your life up too. And we all have empathy for that because it makes total sense to us. But it doesn't... It's because we're so far from having experienced Justin Bieber's life of just owning the world at age 14, people really don't understand how that just set him up to be miserable. And they blame his character, even though it's exactly what has happened to so many other celebrity children. It's like, how many times has this pattern played out before we're willing to say this isn't a character defect of the individual? It's exactly what happens when you're super famous at age 13.
And I think what you have to recognize is that you can still maintain a position of, like, look, I want to have increased personal responsibility. So whether you're the rich pop star who becomes an asshole or whether you're the poor kid from the projects who becomes a gangbanger, like, some people do make it out. We want to encourage you to approach your life as if you are not doomed, which you are technically not.
Like, of course,
even though there's a high percentage of outcomes that might fall into that negative.
I would be super curious to know what percentage of kids get famous and then don't have mental health consequences because of it compared to how many people have abusive parents. It might be similar-ish, in which case it's like, yeah, you can have the worst, most traumatic childhood ever and still make it out and be successful, well-adjusted, non-abusive when you're a parent, wealthy based on your own pull-your-up-by-your-bootstraps type mentality, but it doesn't mean it wasn't harder because of the circumstances. Mm-hmm. And you can be a well-adjusted kid who happens to be famous, but it's definitely harder because of the circumstances, but nobody has that same level of empathy for you. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You don't look at the Harry Potter kids and amazed at the ones that didn't end up fucked up because of it.
Yes. What I found interesting, and I don't know that it's true, because there was... I forget what it was, the Jonathan Haidt book, which is the, I don't know if it was The Righteous Mind or something, but it talks about how the Democrats or left-leaning people are higher in the care like metric that you measure. Do they care and have a big heart, lots of empathy? Mm-hmm. And I think that that could still potentially be true on the aggregate. But what is interesting is that it does not extend past a certain group. Oftentimes, it does not extend to the wealthy, at least from what I see and read online. Maybe it does. Maybe some people have understanding. But I've mentioned this. Like, if you were to truly approach the world and not say, view people as individuals and not say, hey, we need to help gays or women or blacks because they are historically oppressed, but instead look at individuals and be like, who is struggling? Who, like, genuinely needs help, would benefit from help? You might wind up in a world where Jeff Bezos required a lot of community attention, even though he has all that money. And that...
You're saying because he might be miserable?
Because he might be miserable. And if you were to look at people as individuals...
Well, he wouldn't get a ton of attention. He'd just get as much attention as everyone else that's equally miserable.
That is equally miserable. Right. Exactly. Exactly.
He's not going to be the most miserable person.
Yeah, he probably
just saying
not.
Like, he's going to get a little bit.
He might get some community care, time, whatever. You know what I mean? Be given his individual circumstances. And that is... People just don't like that, can't imagine that. They think that once you have a certain level of material wealth, any problem that you have is Cry Me a River territory.
Sure.
You know, it just doesn't matter.
I don't think the problems are worse, though. Like, when I say no. I know families that tear each other apart because they are trying to claw back granddad's money after he dies, they're not more miserable than the people who are having a bunch of infighting because they are impoverished and are struggling to get food. I'm just saying that their circumstances... predictably lead there often, which is they don't make the wealth themselves, then they turn on each other, and that leads to unhappiness because they don't have a sense of achievement or strong familial bonds, which is what actually makes you happy no matter what your wealth level is.
Well,
it doesn't mean that they're worse off than the people who
they
are.
They could be, and we've talked about
probably
Avicii.
A tie.
No, we've talked about Avicii, and I've lived with poor people. I've lived with poor people.
A lot of poor people kill themselves too, though. Like Avicii's a tie with all the other suicidal.
But you're treating them as groups. I'm saying I've lived with individuals who are very poor in Costa Rica and were way better off than Avicii.
Well, I think poverty in Costa Rica is different than poverty in the U.S. because I think happiness is all about expectations. And so in the U.S., you could have the same level of poverty in different countries and have a very different sense of happiness based on your circumstances.
Sure, I agree with that. I'm just saying that I'm 100% certain there's someone in America who is impoverished, who is way better off from a subjective experiential standpoint than Avicii was.
Yeah, I don't think anyone would fight that.
Exactly. So then you were just saying like, I say it's a tie and not worse. I think you would have to look at each individual to determine whether it was a tie or worse or better based on their own subjective experience. And then of course it's tough to compare.
Yeah.
Across.
Yes, you're saying, the point you're trying to make, I think, is that the wealth doesn't cause you to have a sphere of invincibility around you when it comes to being miserable. Mm-hmm. I'm saying I agree. It's not to say that that means that you're worse off than somebody who's, like, it's not worse than being poor. You're
Correct.
Just saying it doesn't automatically make you happy because you have resources.
Yeah.
Which I agree with.
And all this being said, it's probably a good thing to aim to reduce poverty because the predictable struggles that you have there are often solved by escaping poverty. And then you get other problems that, you know, need different approaches to
exactly.
To ameliorate your suffering. But it was just interesting to watch and just the admitted zero empathy. I was like, wow, this is wild. Like, this entire article just explained to you how miserable things are in a way that you can't understand. You just are like, I don't see it at all.
Yeah.
Was the position.
Well, I've experienced this. It's fun to be judgmental.
Of course.
And it's fun to talk shit on people, and it's fun to schadenfreude, mm-hmm. and to feel superior to people. And you lose all of that with empathy. Mm. And if you have empathy, you won't shit talk anybody. Like, anytime you're ever shit talking someone, anytime you're ever schadenfreuding and feeling good from their pain, anytime you're judging someone just to feel superior, you're lacking empathy. Mm-hmm. And when you have the empathy, you get none of those temporarily great feelings. And so I think she feels awesome shitting on those people.
For sure.
And doesn't want to give that up in exchange for understanding them better. Mm-hmm. That's a very unappealing short-term trade. And in the long term, obviously, it's much better for her because there's costs to to the short-term yumminess of being spiteful and having schadenfreude and being mm-hmm. judgmental and everything you do to the external world.
What do you think the costs are?
You turn them back on yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Everything you do to the external world, you turn back on yourself. When you're super judgmental to other people and you're getting off on pointing out all their
flaws. I would never do that. I'm better than that. Yeah.
You are doing all of that to yourself. And when you walk around being like, I think what you're doing is wrong, but I understand how you got there. I wish you wouldn't speed through the neighborhood, but I appreciate based on your circumstances, you have to be this way. I wish you wouldn't rob the bank, but I understand based on your circumstances. Why. Then when you fuck up and look back on your own mistakes, you will have that same level of, I get why you did that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have any malice for you and I don't whip you internally. Mm-hmm. And so I think in the long run, everyone would be happier to have more empathy for other people because I think they would all be much kinder to themselves in their own heads.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so unappealing to tell that to people in the moment because it feels so good temporarily to just shit on other people.
Yes. And so it is
people don't want to give that up.
Like lots of the good things in the world that people don't do, it doesn't happen immediately. It's like, okay, I stop judging other people. You're not like immediately like, oh, wow, like a sense of self-love just surging inside right. of me and I'm kinder to myself.
Well, no, it's a habit. You have a lifetime exactly, of habits. Yeah. And depending on what your habits, some people have a lifetime of empathy habits. They just never, anytime people talk shit, they get weirded out or they defend the person. And that person just has the habit of being kind to themselves probably. Mm-hmm. But yeah, if you have a lifetime of validating yourself by making yourself superior to other people by pointing out how dumb they are or whatever your thing is, yeah, stopping it for a day isn't going to stop that habit. You have to break the habit over time.
Mm-hmm. Very good. So that was one.
Cool.
What else have we?
I got something I think you'll find is interesting.
Sure.
Because I know that you're big into this kind of stuff. Leading cause of death for people ages 18 to 45.
Cars?
Fentanyl overdoses.
No shit.
Yeah. So we talked on the podcast.
Cars was the one that I can't control.
No, cars used to be also. So this fentanyl overdoses has gotten past COVID, car accidents, and suicide.
Mm.
And it's become the leading cause of death age 18 to 45. And I know we've talked on here about how not all death is created equal. And when you die at age 99, the amount of healthy human life that's been lost is probably like a month, right? Like if you die of a car accident at age 99, in a month, you're probably going to die of something else. But when you're 19, you die of a fentanyl overdose, that's a lot of human years lost.
Yeah.
And it's just interesting. It's for people who don't know what fentanyl is, it's a drug that you cut with other drugs that is cheaper.
I thought it was like heroin plus.
It's an opioid. People don't know what the word cut is. You combine it with other drugs because it's cheaper than those drugs and it's really strong. Now, the downside is it's super deadly. But if you get it right, you can create a similar high. So the person thinks they're buying heroin or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And they get the same high they're expecting, but
the margin for error is much smaller because it's so much stronger.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And just fascinating because it's the leading cause of death in the U.S. from age 18 to 45, which is a demographic you'd think people would care about.
Yeah.
And no one talks about it. And you could.
Well, I don't know if that's true. I've heard some about fentanyl, but.
Dude, I haven't seen anybody on any of the major news channels talk about it. No one brought it up in Thanksgiving conversation. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's just not, to me at least, it's not part of the national dialogue.
I understand what you're saying. It's like, it's not COVID or Omicron. It's not that popular. I'm familiar with fentanyl, but
yes. Okay. It's not. And by the way, I'm not trying to diminish these other things, but it's not COVID or gun control.
Sure. It's definitely not gun control.
It's not like how much news coverage are we getting and how much debate are people having with their friends about how this has to get solved? How this is a unbelievably unacceptable problem to have.
You know, what's interesting is I think the things that rise to national consciousness require opposition. So like if everybody in America had a very similar stance on COVID, which is like, yeah, we're going to wear masks and like some people shouldn't get vaccines, but some people will. And we all just agreed. I think we'd be talking about COVID way less. It's almost like the debate and the disagreement there is why it is such a popular topic. And with fentanyl, I don't think people are like, that's a good thing. They're like, yeah, it's bad. We shouldn't have it. And everybody just kind of.
Dude, it's so solvable. This is the interesting thing. The U.S. government is making this happen.
Mm-hmm.
Every single one of these deaths is on the hands of the U.S. government. If they just legalized drugs you wouldn't have to cut it with fentanyl. You would be able to go mm-hmm. to a CVS and buy drugs instead of going to a guy who's telling you something that you don't know what it is.
Yeah.
You'd have all these deaths go to zero, literally. Maybe there'd be people who are buying it because it's cheaper on the street, but you'd have them dropping significantly. And not that anyone really seems to care, but you'd also see, like, seriously help Mexico and all the violence that occurs from the drug cartels over there that are running the
cities. That where fentanyl comes from?
Yeah. And so...
I thought it was China. I don't know. It's
both.
Yeah.
It's both. Yeah. So basically, well, also, but think about it. If you legalize every drug, you don't just interrupt fentanyl sales, which do come from Mexico and China. Mm-hmm. You also interrupt cocaine sales.
Cocaine, yeah.
Which, as soon as we legalized marijuana, the Mexican drug trade just turned steeper towards cocaine, basically.
Yeah.
Because there's still some illegal marijuana, but I mean, it's just clearly a diminishing market as people are able to just go to MedMen and buy it, you know, with no problem with a credit card. So yeah, this is the number one cause of deaths, people age 18 to 45, and the U.S. government has the solution whenever they want it, and they don't do it.
Yeah.
Nobody talks about it. No one is upset about it. And I just find that really interesting that nobody is up in arms demanding that we just legalize all these drugs so that people stop dying of fentanyl.
Yeah, I'd like to hear the counter argument. It does seem like one of the easy ones that I feel like we have examples of prohibition. Like, we had pre-prohibition, a prohibition, and a post-prohibition. We saw that an entire mob and industry formed around it that was extremely violent and had, I believe, far worse consequences than the legalization and regulation of it. Missed out on all that tax money mm-hmm. that we could have got, and was just not a good idea.
No, the counter argument is we don't want people. I mean, I'll try not to straw man it, but I think it's just like we don't want people doing heroin. And if you legalize heroin, people are going to do heroin. To which I say, people are doing heroin.
I don't want people eating McDonald's. You know, like I don't want.
Or
I don't
smoking cigarettes or drinking soda.
I really think if we approach these things, we'd be like, we really don't want people eating shitty fast food. Like, that is really not what we want. It's not good for them. It's not good. Yes, that. But there's this moral, I wonder if it's because of our puritanical origins, approach to drugs. That's the other thing. People, predictably, and I was definitely in this category, have different groups of things. So when you tell someone that they're going to have a vegetable or a vitamin or a supplement, they have one approach to it. Mm-hmm. But if it's categorized in the drug category, that's bad. What's interesting is that people take caffeine mm-hmm. and these other things. They don't consider them drugs.
You're not high on coffee right now.
Yeah.
I had half a cup this morning.
They would never say that, you know, very few people would say that they're high on coffee. To talk about caffeine addiction is treated so lightly. I mean, you get headaches. It screws you up when you try to get off coffee.
Oh, dude, I used to work in private equity and we worked long hours. And I knew a guy that was addicted to Red Bull and we all told him he was going to die of it because he was doing 5 cans of Red Bull a day, I think.
Yeah.
And so eventually he's like, okay, I'm going to stop. Mm-hmm. He made it, I think, 2 or 3 days during which he was having just nonstop sweating and shaking and headaches. And he couldn't function. He couldn't work. He's like, I feel nauseous. I have headaches. I'm sweating and shaking. And just gave up, went back to caffeine, said, I'll figure this out when I go to grad school.
It's interesting because when I discuss psychedelics with people that are not in that world and haven't thought about it, the objection is always like, but that's drugs. Mm-hmm. And I find myself having to go back to this description of like, look, what you conceive of as a drug and don't conceive of as a drug is kind of silly. Like,
well, psychedelic people know this. They've been calling them psychedelic medicines.
Yeah, they understand.
There's a strong attempt to relabel them as psychedelic medicines.
Yeah. And I think medicine, and I understand why they call it medicine, isn't an appropriate, that will be switched soon too, because people take medicines like Robitussin, it's supposed to do all the work for you. And I think that approach to psychedelics is not going to play out very well.
Yeah.
When you're just like, oh, I'll just take this and I'll be good. It's not going to work. So
yeah, I don't know if that's worth diving into, but we just have some anecdotal experiences and our own experiences of psychedelics just being half the battle and how mm-hmm. important it is to have good guidance and therapeutic mm-hmm. I don't know, help for mm-hmm. integration. Otherwise, it's very likely to do nothing or not go well.
Yeah. And for some people, they're like, I took a massive dose of mushrooms and I'm not afraid of dying anymore. It's like, great. That's awesome.
Sure,
I'm glad that it worked out for you. You do not want that to be the standard protocol for most people. Just like, hey, take a heavy dose of this psychedelic and you'll be better.
Well, that's the other thing. I mean, you could have high-end facilities for heroin that cost extra. Mm-hmm. For the rich and famous, where you go and they're monitoring your vitals. And while mm-hmm. you're on your heroin high, they are giving you an IV or whatever it is. And listen, I'm not saying we want.
I wonder
people-
if heroin could be used like psychedelics, where there's like interaction on it, and it's like, what do you like about, you know, where there's talk therapy going on while you're on an opioid.
My understanding is that heroin's very dangerous and no one should do it. Mm-hmm. But I don't think making it illegal has led to that. Mm-hmm. So I think you might as well legalize it, try to make it as safe as possible to use, so that people stop dying of overdoses and we stop funding cartels.
There was one guy in New York who was a professor who admitted to using it recreationally for many, many years, which...
He was microdosing, which I still wouldn't recommend.
Yeah, no, I certainly wouldn't recommend it.
I don't think he was like train spotting himself, just shooting up and being like, here I go.
Well, this is kind of, I think most people watching this know that, and you know that, I don't have to tell you, but I'll say it, is that people treat addiction and drugs as if it's 100% related to whatever the substance is and not related to the style of use, what's going on inside you, how you're using it as a coping mechanism, and your likelihood to become dependent on it the exclusion of other things.
I spoke to a guy that runs an Ibogaine clinic. People don't know that's a hardcore psychedelic. That's like the more extreme version of ayahuasca. And people use it. One of the reasons they use it is PTSD. So he'll have a lot of Navy SEALs come in. But the other is to break heroin addiction. And he says this treatment is 0% effective if you come, break the physical addiction, and then move back into the same apartment with the same social friend group and the same job, because everything that got you to do heroin the first time will just get you back to doing heroin. So he says, I can break the physical addiction in 3 weeks, straight up, zero question. And then we have to work together on creating a new life that doesn't lead the person back to heroin.
Mm-hmm. Very good. New topic?
Yeah, go for it.
So... there was, I guess I clicked something related to the Rittenhouse trial, and now Twitch drama shows up on my YouTube, which is,
okay.
Twitch is like high school, man. At least the stuff that I've been seeing. Maybe it's because that's what I clicked for Rittenhouse, but there's just so much drama. It is ridiculous. So one of the big things now is there's one guy, Hassan Abi, I don't really know him that well, is banned on Twitch. And banned means, they use the word ban, I think, inappropriately. Mm. It's like for a limited time. My understanding of ban is that it's in other contexts, using me like you're never coming back, like exile. But yeah, he's got
suspended.
He's suspended.
The term is suspended.
Suspended seems like the more appropriate term. And maybe that helps stir up the drama, like banned instead of suspended, which is like, oh, boring.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you pop for steroids in a sport, you get suspended. If you get banned, you're never coming back.
He said he was saying now, you know, Twitch is very sensitive to slurs and bad words and all these kind of things. Mm-hmm. And he said that someone was a cracker in an angry way. And now there's this whole, is the C word really bad? Is it as bad as the N word? Is it this? Does it have the historical context? No, it doesn't. And there's these arguments that to me are so stupid.
I know it's not as bad as the N word because you just said it on the podcast, and I promise you, you're not going to drop the N word. So societally, at least.
Well, no, but again, society, the idea, I think there's one. People discuss language as if, first, historical context matters, which it fucking doesn't. It is an agreed upon matrix that we all live in, and if 50, 60, 70, 80 years ago were all an imagination, and you had an invading force that just told the whole generation of kids, they're like, hey, there's a historical context to this, even though the word was never used badly, would it make a difference? It's all about the beliefs of the group of people that are mm-hmm. using a word. So I hate these references to, like, historically, what does it mean? That has nothing to do with the reaction that people have. And there's all these silly... comments about the objective, the people seeming to tie down like an objective meaning of a word and ascribe some sort of valence or value to how strong or bad it is, which just seems like people don't understand language. And the other thing is that when we discuss these things, I think it's so silly that this is an old take, the context doesn't matter, that I have to sit here and say C word, N word, and as if the mere uttering of a sound...
I don't invoked. Think you have to, do you have to say C word? You can't just say cracker?
Definitely can't say N word. As if the mere uttering of a sound would invoke hatred down. You know, it's just like, and it's crazy. But also the idea that, like, you know, this was always weird to me when I was a kid. I was like, wait, I can't say damn, but I can say darn. So if I look at you and I go, darn you, you squiggle licking, face smacking, you know what I mean, with such vitriol that is somehow
less bad though in the sense that it doesn't feel like you just did it. It's completely emotionless to receive.
Yes,
be called a squiggle-faced wiggle-wong.
Yeah,
even with hate in your heart, like, actually, I think there is something in the sense of words we've talked about this in Charisma, like what someone understands you to have said is what you said.
It's a collective hallucination.
When you're trying to persuade someone or when you're in an argument and you're saying something and they're like, you said blank and you feel misunderstood. Yes. But when it comes to persuasion, all that matters is what they heard. You know what I'm saying? When it comes to persuasion.
Yeah. Yeah.
When it comes to persuasion.
Oh, and persuasion is a practical consideration though. So if anybody who makes a practical argument for this,
in hate, it also matters. Because all the hate in your heart, while you call me a squirrel-faced tail wagger, it won't affect me because it's not a charged word in my mind. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the power of the word, is if it's charged in the person on the receiving end, then it's going to create a more emotional reaction.
I think it's reaction. I think it is a mistake to say it is simply, because look, when we were approaching Charisma, all we cared about were results. So we pretty hard divorced ourselves from our intention and focused on like how is what we're being received.
Yeah, yeah, and I don't think that's necessarily bad advice. If you're not trying to be creepy, but every person you talk to gets creeped out, you should assess what's mm-hmm. happening, because mm-hmm. I don't think that you as the speaker are the sole arbiter of what you're saying. So if the whole world thinks that you're creepy, you should take that feedback and reflect on the fact that you're creeping people out instead of being like, no, but my intent isn't to be creepy and the words I'm using aren't creepy. It's like, you don't get to decide that on your own. Mm-hmm. Like the world gets to tell you to some extent if you're creepy.
Yeah. And for the purposes of learning charisma, I think it's a pretty good idea to put reality outside of your perception and say reality is what I think you might be in the way, my guy.
All right, bud. You're the star of the show. For everybody who's listening right now, on the podcast, you'll be confused. But it's fine. If you're watching, this is Charlie's dog.
Shit over here. Thank you. I forget what I was saying. But yeah, that... I don't think it's fair to say, because then you run into this problem. If you go, language is what other people perceive, then other people, should they choose to...
No, I'm saying it's partially is what they perceive.
Yes, partially. It's a negotiation. It's a collective, ongoing hallucination negotiation, which...
Yeah, I think if you... I mean, not to beat to death. If you, with all the hate in your heart, just yell things that don't make sense to the other person, they're going to laugh. Like, yes. Your intent alone does not control... communication.
Yes, but if all of a sudden a group of people decide to think that darn is the worst slur, or that, you know, some yeah. common thing that I say.
Well, if it's a big enough group, then yeah, they totally then, get to.
And here's it. But what we have to recognize, they will be effective. Practically, that will become true for social interactions, but it does not make it like philosophically, metaphysically true. And so when I hear these arguments, they're often trying to find some sort of like objective floor on which to build their reason why they are right. Instead of just saying, my group's in power right now in terms of deciding what this is, or like the people that, not my group, most people agree with me right now. So it's true. You know, that's all it is. But I hear all these other arguments about history, which doesn't matter. It really is just what most people, and you take each of those people and you multiply by their power in society, believe, and then you have your answer of, what's good, bad, and neutral in the world. And it's obviously evolving because those people's perceptions and power in society is evolving. So that's it. And I think I agree with what you're saying, which is if other people tell you that it's bad, it becomes bad practically. Mm-hmm. It's just when I listen to these arguments, they're...
And not just bad. Flattering.
Yeah.
Creepy.
Wonderful.
Dude, thick. When did thick become a compliment? Right? I guess I'm just saying it's not just bad.
No, it's like, it's all
the society
words.
Really gets to tell you what all the words mean.
Yeah. That's sick, dude. Dope. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah, yeah.
Why is this a good
sick.
Thing?
Why is sick good?
Dude, you're the shit.
Yeah. So it's not just slurs. That's just how language works.
Yes.
It's what words do.
I guess here's the thing. In terms of having...
By the way, all words, their meaning is literally just defined by the society, and that's why different countries have different words for the same...
Which is why I think no thing. In Chinese sounds similar to the N-word, and you can't get mad about it. Or you can. You're allowed to, technically. It's just...
Yeah, language is just an agreement.
So here's what I'm saying. If you happen to be a person who agrees with American society writ large, have compassion for somebody that didn't grow up in the same type of spheres and bubbles and doesn't use words the same way as you do and might mean things without the intent and power which you ascribe to them. And I think that's part of my issue with these words and what people say, any of their slurs that are unacceptable, is that you might have the experience that is now dominant in terms of what most people perceive these words to be and how bad they are, but somebody else might not and might use them totally bad. So I guess I'm just saying, obviously, look for context.
Well, wasn't this guy's context? Wasn't he trying to use cracker as a
slur? He was.
So seems pretty down the fairway in terms of...
Yeah, the thing for me is, again, if I were running these social media platforms, and maybe this is impractical.
He tried to use it like a racial slur.
Yes.
So his intent was to racially slur someone.
Yes.
I don't even think it's a bad word, but if you're going based on... If you're trying to do context, the context here is you tried to use this like it was a hateful word. Yeah. So
it's
pretty fair to suspend
him. Well, and this is unfortunately, I think, Twitch is going to be... maybe they are into it. The game that they're playing now is just this flow of new bad things that you can't say. It's going to evolve, and there's just going to constantly be people on the edge that are getting banned. What they mean is suspended. They use all words funny, I guess.
Yeah.
That's just the game they've decided to play is...
What I'm saying is I don't mind the word, but if your goal is to suspend people when they say a word that is purposely meant to be derogatory and hurtful towards a specific race, this guy violated that policy.
Again, but it's also, which I get, and they're a big company and they have to have these blanket policies and things don't make sense, but he, prior to that, is like, people all the time on Twitch would be like, fuck you, you piece of shit, mother... You know, like, with such...
Sorry, Justin, you don't get paid for this episode.
you can bleep it. You can bleep it. That you can be so hateful. So obviously, like, what emotion is that person expressing? We would all agree, oh, that's hate. Like, he fucking hates that person. And if you don't say one of the no-no words, you're fine. But if you use a no-no word describing something, you know, like you're reading Huckleberry Finn, you drop the N-word without calling it the N-word, now that's hate speech. It's just very, the way that we approach speech today in online communities lacks philosophical rigor.
Is that true? I actually don't know.
I'm pretty sure if you read Huckleberry Finn on Twitch, when you say it, you are going to look at a ban.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And because some of the people that said the word, not this guy, it wasn't in, there were a lot of mods that also got banned that were describing it or talking about it or saying, it's okay to say this, like it's okay to say the C word. They were banned as well.
I'd be surprised if reading Huckleberry Finn got you banned.
You could try it. Definitely would. It'd also definitely get you like shitstormed if you had any sort of public size, like if PewDiePie read Huckleberry Finn. Mm-hmm. Now again, why did he elect to read that? And maybe to prove a point about language, maybe because he hates black, who knows, you know, but people would read into it all sorts of...
I mean, you don't get to control public opinion. So if you didn't get banned, but everyone got mad at you, that seems reasonable to me. Mm-hmm. Not reasonable in the sense that it's justified, but just in the sense that you don't get to say you're not allowed to be mad at me.
Sure.
I don't think I did anything wrong. You're not allowed to be mad at me.
Well, I guess I wish that people were more sophisticated about their approach to language. And I understand that they're not going to be.
Just to be clear, that's not top 10 on my wishes.
No.
Like, it'd be nice, but it's not that important relative to all the other things I'd wish for first.
I would be 6'2", first and foremost.
I was actually thinking, I wasn't going to bring it up, obviously. But I was actually thinking about I'm doing these videos on dating, and everybody always writes in, you know, attractiveness and how attractive the celebrities are. And I feel like attraction is so much in your control, with the exception of height. Like, I think attraction is made up of your height.
For men, you mean?
For men, yeah. Your height, your fitness, your style, your hair. There's so much that goes into it, and you can control
your facial structure.
I think facial structure for men is so low on the totem pole, actually.
It's not so low. if you're on the extremes, but there's things that you can do to, like, if you can grow a beard and you don't have fantastic facial structure, you can grow a dope beard and just cut it the way that you want it to
look. Also, just if you get in shape, your face will naturally kind of square out. Mm-hmm. And that's generally what people say is attractive in men in America. It's just square defined features, which is just what happens if you are fit. So I feel like those go together. And I was thinking about it, there's all these things that are in your control, and then there's just height, and it's just not. Mm-hmm. And that's just the hand you get dealt, and then you just have to deal with it and get shamed for it because nobody stands up for you when people tease you for your height. And it's just the thing that you're going to get picked on, that people are going to choose not to date you for, that no one defends you for. Like, you can't body shame for weight, but you can totally body shame for height. Yeah. I was just thinking about it. I was like, that's the hardest hand, I think, as a man.
I know you don't mean it this way, but there's lots of worse things that you could get.
For attractiveness?
There's a lot of worse things that you could genetically happen to. Yeah.
Sure. I guess
there's all kinds of diseases and things and disfigurations and.
Yes. But if you're going, think about the bell curve. What's the height equivalent of that? You're saying like you could be born with no face at all. Like, okay, yes, that would be worse.
I understand what you're saying. I understand. You're talking about the most of the commenters on YouTube, the things that they complain about, the one that you say and you go, I have some understanding for this because this genuinely is not something that you can change and is something that people will judge you on. Mm-hmm. And that you don't have a tremendous amount of influence or any, except if you're wearing boots, is height.
Or to which you do I that agree. Shin-breaking surgery.
Yeah, like in Gattaca.
They have it. Literally, people hate their height so much that they'll just go to a doctor and you break your shin bones, and then you put metal in to stretch your bone, your body out, and then the bone regrows to connect, and then you do it again and again.
Wow.
And it's extremely painful.
We'll do a charisma for short guys, right? We were talking about that at some point. And again, some people's going to go, they're not short enough, but we're talking about like Kevin Hart, who's 5'2", Tom Holland, who's dating Zendaya, I think he's 5'7".
Well, I also don't, it's, celebrity heights are a mystery.
Yeah, they're confused.
Depending on where you go. They're and who like, you look at them standing next to.
They're all 2 inches taller than they say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's tough.
Kevin Hart is definitely 5'2". He
says 5'4".
Does
except
he?
Except for sometimes when he says 5'2".
Okay. He's quite short.
Yeah.
So maybe we'll do that video at some point. The other thing that, watching MacGruber, and I've mentioned this before, I love MacGruber. This is my guy. I named him after it. Now finally he gets to stay.
People don't know, there's a TV show called MacGruber.
I named my dog after the cult classic MacGruber because he's got the same haircut. But the running joke is that he has a really small penis, and I cannot imagine that being made, whatever the analog is for a female, and being okay. And it's also to be a guy out there feeling like that's you as you watch this, and it just gets teased relentlessly, and there's no pushback, there's no response that he has. It is just a deep shame that he has to deal with constantly, and it's the butt of every joke is, it's wild to me how obvious the extension of the compassion should be. You know, you can't fat shame, you can't this. It's like, here's a thing that people have zero control over, that we know some percentage of the population is going to be small because that's how bell curves work. There is small, there is medium, and there is large for whatever it is that you are. And that, you know, the big dick energy is such a common compliment. It's wild to me that the compassionate stuff can't make such an obvious jump to the next obvious realm of where compassion ought to be extended.
Yeah, why do you think that? Because I think when people are in their empathetic mindset, that's obvious what you're saying.
Yeah.
Why do you think it has made no ground at all relative to fat shaming?
Stand up for themselves or organize
or
say
self-identify.
That's me.
I think that's the big one, is you'll see people on TikTok and they'll be like, my college is fat phobic, no one wants to date me, and they're 400 pounds, and it's like, well, you can't deny that you're 400 pounds, so you might as well just come out against fat phobic people. But you can try to hide if you don't self-identify,
which is a little bit like, I imagine what gay was like 50, 60 years ago, or I don't know how many, but where it was, you could deny it plausibly. And so it was, don't say anything. Just, I also don't like that.
That's what I think, that's the biggest thing that stops it from, no one is going to advocate for that community, because it's there's some people will, but it's rare to self-identify as even being in that community. So then you can't, you don't have any advocates, you don't have any celebrities coming out and like, don't body shame for this.
There's also not, I mean, what there isn't, and again, it's just, I'm thinking, I don't know if that's true. Because I was thinking if that was one of the few groups of people to which there is not a subset that's like, I love this, this is amazing. And so there's like, there is fat positivity. There is obviously gay positivity. Like if you're a gay person, you're like, I'm into that, you know? I haven't seen a subgroup of people that's like, I love that, you know, small dick energy. That's so great. But yeah, it's just, I was watching, I was like, man, this is a, you do realize that I don't care what the average size is. 15 to 20 are in the bottom 15 to 20%. You know what I mean? Like you, people, it's just so obvious.
Yeah. And one in eight guys is going to be upset by this.
And by the way, I'm the type of person that if I were like owner of the culture, I'd be like, make fun of everything and everybody. Go make fun of the bigs and the smalls and the littles and the like, just, I would be way more permissive than current society. But if you are going to restrict the jokes that can be told, my God, this seems like a logical extension that you're unwilling to pick up on people. What the heck? So, MacGruber.
Okay. Good.
Anything else that you had?
Yeah. We talked about cap gains, and I saw a comment that I wanted to reply to.
Oh, just I had
to
one, try to too. Clarify. What was yours?
So this is something, hold on, let me dig it up, because I saw it, and I've thought we addressed it, but maybe we didn't address these arguments.
I wrote one as well.
This person was... So he writes, I absolutely love the podcast.
I wrote that one too.
Thank you. But I thought the segment on cap gains taxes was a bit reductive. For example, Charlie said it's ridiculous to assume that raising the capital gains tax will reduce investment because people will still invest their money. That's true, but there will be less new investment than there was because it's objectively less valuable to invest than it was before.
Can we pause there?
Yeah. So I would argue investing, when you decide to invest, you are not comparing it to what investing was like 6 months ago. You are comparing it to the alternative to investing, which is holding cash. And holding cash is a negative return because we have never been in a deflate. I mean, I won't say never. Cash inflates on average in the US. And so,
which means it loses value.
So if you were able to invest and after capital gains tax, you were getting 7% on your money. And now with the new cap gains, you're only getting 6% on your money. That is still more appealing than holding cash and having a slight negative return as cash becomes less valuable. So I don't think that raising capital gains, especially if you're talking about from 25 to 35%, will reduce investing because that is not your alternative. Your alternative isn't to go back in time and invest when cap gains were lower. And so it is still the logical thing to do to take your 6% instead of your 7% rather than hold cash. So
I wrote literally the same comment and stopped at the same point and was, just to be clear, capital gains? Yeah, they're only on gains that you make. So if you lose money, you're in the same boat as you were before, whatever the rate is. Mm-hmm. If you make money, you're making more than you would have in cash. I actually don't think it would reduce investment at all.
I agree.
If it were, unless there were some other loophole where people could find their 20%. But if you made income taxed at whatever, 35, 40%, you would not reduce investment one iota, assuming there was no way to escape the U.S. taxes.
Right. Now, what you might have is people renouncing their citizenship and moving to Singapore, but actually that is so drastic that I think very few people, based on a tax gains increase of 25% of your capital gains to 35% of your capital gains, I don't think many people are going to renounce their U.S. citizenship and stop, give up their right to live in the country, basically, to go live in Singapore or...
Yeah, maybe one or two ultra-wealthy people. Mm-hmm. Maybe. It could happen, but... Yes, your average person who is not moving is going to invest, I would argue, identically, in even if you raise cap gains. So that was my thought as well.
Yeah. Honestly, the rest of this comment is just about why that's bad, but I don't agree with the premise.
I don't agree with the premise. Yep. That's funny. That's exactly what I wrote. Anything else?
Yes. So one thing I did want to clarify and then talk
about. Thanks for the comment, honestly. It was respectful, well-written. I appreciate it.
Yeah, agreed. Me too. I'm not calling it out to try to call you out. I just thought that it was worth addressing since apparently we did not, in your mind, compellingly address that the first time. Mm-hmm. One thing that isn't an argument for more taxes. I think the government does things terribly. In my mind, it's a question of why not raise capital gains and lower income taxes, because I think you can get the same tax revenue in a way that... the people that are paying taxes are more in line with who most people would want to be paying taxes. But I do think the government is awful at a lot of things. And so one thing I want to say is, for people who want big government, the DMV is an awful experience. The IRS is an awful experience. Malibu regularly loses power because they don't invest in putting their power lines underground, but they have a monopoly.
Well, I don't know if that's a government agency or a government-protected monopoly.
That's what I'm saying. It's a government-protected monopoly.
Yeah. But there's reasons for that.
Private enterprise is great. Big government often leads to things being shitty. And this is not me saying that I want overall tax revenue increased, nor that I think the government does good things with their money.
They sometimes do. We have to give them some credit. The interstate system is pretty fucking incredible.
Oh, I'm not saying they always do something bad. I'm just saying you can argue that capital gains tax doesn't make sense and should go up, and then just say, we'll offset that by making income taxes go down. Mm-hmm. It's not automatically a point that the government should just get more money. It's more a question of why. The question is, why are capital gains suppressed relative to income taxes?
Mm-hmm. And even prior to that is there's a philosophical question of, what should the government be in charge of? What do they do better than private industry? Where better is not defined as necessarily cheaper, but, you know, get it to everyone, raise a minimum quality of life. And people can disagree there, which would lead to different tax rates and how much revenue they ought to be collecting for the job that they have. But if we assume that we agree upon that, then you go, okay, how do you want to get that tax revenue? I totally agree that having this way of earning extra money that is from money as not being taxed at the same rate as other income is silly. The other that we talked
about.
Well,
also, just to be clear, though, if your concern, which I think isn't what would result, is that if you do this, you're going to take lower class and middle class people who are trying to invest, and you're going to hurt them in some way. You could just have a tax bracket type thing. Where you go, listen, for your first, how about this?
How about it's the same as
$100,000?
Income is income. Let's just call it income.
I'm not saying $100,000 invested. I'm saying for the first $100,000 you make on capital gains, we'll keep it at 25. Mm-hmm. When you make more than $100,000 in a year off capital gains, we'll go 28. When you make more than $500,000, we'll go 30. Like, I think you can do this in a way, because that's the other thing I saw in the comments. Some people were saying, well, this, you know, not, it's not, this isn't just the uber wealthy that invest. I go, I agree. You can make rules for this. It's just that some people are making millions of dollars a year on their cap gains while having no income. Mm-hmm. And so then that person is just paying a smaller relative tax rate than someone who makes 120 grand salary and doesn't have any family wealth. And so has very few investments.
Well, we don't need to talk about this, but I thought about this. Elon Musk tweeted that he's going to pay $11 billion in taxes this year. It's a lot of money. Now, it might not be percentage-wise, given how much he is worth, but this comes to the question of how and why do people pay taxes? Are they paying because they are able? Are they paying because their neighbors prefer them to? Which I know it was just a word that you said, but you're like, that's not how most people would want. Well, do we just tax people based on majority rule? What is the philosophical principle behind taxes? And I actually don't know that it's been clearly articulated. Like, we talk about fair share without discussing what's fair. Mm-hmm. what if Elon Musk really did have, what if Elon Musk was born with 8 brains and 8 hands and he was just doing it all, doing them all himself and doing it? Would we still tax him the same amount? If so, that implies that the philosophy behind it is it's not about how much you've withdrawn from the system. It's about you're just capable. If you're just capable, you just put back in.
Yeah, that is what it is in my mind.
Well, some people don't think it ought to be that.
Oh,
some
I don't think your taxes should be like, okay, let's look at Charlie. Let's look at how many roads he drives on. Let's look at how many kids he has in public school. Let's look at how many, and then we'll have everybody pay there. At that point, you're not really even doing taxes. You're just having, it's just people are paying for services like it's a business. The idea of taxes is that should not be the case. That actually, what you want to do is have people paying based on their means. Because otherwise you just wouldn't have taxes. You would literally just have people pay tolls on every road and pay.
Not exactly, because Elon Musk benefits from having a collective group of people he can sell from. There is an argument to be made that his wealth comes from the community, right? Because he is selling to a community.
Yeah, but you still wouldn't look at the individual government resources that he used up.
Correct.
You'd then have to look at the government resources every one of his clients used, basically, to do that math. Mm-hmm. But no, I think it's general. My impression is that taxes generally are a it's supposed to be based on your means back to the collective. And that's why it's based on how much income you make. I mean, imagine a world with no cap gains, just salaries. The idea would be that the amount of taxes you pay is directly related to how wealthy you are and how much income tax.
Sure. But there are Republicans that think that what's fair is a flat tax. That is just, and the flat tax
is flat.
Well, some of them say a flat amount of money. Others will say a flat rate. So everybody pays.
Flat rate is still philosophically the idea that the more wealth you have, the more you should contribute to the whole.
Yes.
That's the same idea.
Yes.
Flat dollar rate, I've literally never heard anyone argue for.
Everybody just gives, it's like frat dues.
Yeah, I've never heard a single person argue for that. So I haven't had that discussion. I don't know the intricacies of it. But even the idea that they shouldn't have marginal increases in tax rates, still philosophically, you're saying the higher your income, the more you should contribute to the government.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I think.
And then they disagree over how much more you ought to pay.
Yes, but the philosophy behind tax is always that. It's never, oh, you drive more, so you should pay more taxes. Because otherwise, you just get rid of taxes and pay fees.
Yeah, this is just doesn't need to be a discussion, but I was thinking, if I was made president and didn't have to deal with any of the fallout, people might not like this. I would definitely reinstitute the tax on religious institutions.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's absurd that, and Scientology has effectively used this loophole. God bless them, because, why get left out of the scam? that I remember going to the Vatican and just looking at all of the priceless works of art just crammed into back rooms.
Oh, yeah. I didn't think it was worth bringing up, but there's a guy in the U.S. who lives in a mega mansion. He has 7 private jets. He doesn't pay taxes. Never paid taxes in his life because he happens to run a church.
It's ridiculous.
Why does this guy have 7 private jets?
Yeah.
It's not for his clergy. It's not like they get on them.
It's God told him to. Is
his, yeah, yeah.
And I understand why we do historically, and I understand that that's not tenable for an elected official to promise or do.
I mean, be clear, so far to date, you can't even get a non-Christian president. So we're so far away from what you're talking about, which is a policy that hurts the church.
Yeah.
Can't even get a Jewish or atheist.
I wonder, are
president.
University endowments taxed? I feel like there's probably some weird stuff going on with that. I'd have to check, and I won't talk about it this week, but I know that universities can also sometimes fit into this special thing of sacred institutions that don't need to justify why they suck so bad.
You know, it is a total tangent. You know, it's interesting because I've thought to myself, what's worse, being Jewish or atheist? If your goal is to be president,
atheist, 100%.
Bernie clearly thinks atheist because he is, I think, agnostic, but he very much, I remember, was trying to present himself as Jewish when he was running.
Yeah,
and I think he wrote a paper in college that was about agnosticism, and it was a controversy that he was trying to bear. He's like, no, that was just like a philosophical argument I had. It's like, oh, wow, as bad as it is to be Jewish if you're running for president, it's worse to
You're almost unelectable as an atheist. I don't know what Andrew Yang is, but...
Well, I think making it out of the Democratic primary and then making it to president are different. So what weaknesses get picked on when you're running in the primary doesn't really highlight what your biggest weakness is as a candidate.
Sure.
Because it might not matter at all if we're in the primary. And then when you are running, all of a sudden it might come up.
Mm-hmm. But so that's what we got. Anything else from you?
I got one more thing.
Cool.
I didn't know this, so I just thought it was interesting. Apparently, Theranos' biggest mistake was not lying about their product. It was just failing to develop it fast enough. Because when Steve Jobs first presented the iPhone, did you know this? He just presented a total magic show of lies. Like the iPhone just didn't work. And so what he did was he had 7 iPhones and they had predictable times that they crashed and he would just swap them out so they couldn't play a full song. So he'd pull out an iPhone and play a part of a song until it started to crash and then he would turn it off. Just be like, all right, that's the end and we'll move on to the next thing. And he would just hand it out and swap it out with different things. But like a magician, he was trying to make it seem like it was all the same phone. And they had never got it to run successfully without it being obvious in the presentation that it was actually a totally garbage product at the time. But the one time they got it right was when they needed to. And so then the stock price went up and pre-orders went crazy and they got a bunch of money that they then used to make an actually good iPhone. So it was interesting because basically Theranos... and the reason I think it's interesting, sorry, is because everyone lauds Steve Jobs and loves Apple because of the iPhone, which makes me think that if Theranos had just lied, raised billions of dollars, but then somehow gotten the technology right later, they would just be heroes of the American community.
Well, the guy that... And again, who knows? The guy that... Originally, I forget his name, Carol, he wrote the book and we talked to some of the scientists. It said that this is, at least from our current understanding of biology, impossible to take a pinprick of blood and get the data that we need. It's not in there.
I'm just saying we don't penalize you for lying to raise funds.
Well,
we just penalize you if you don't then catch up to your promises.
Yes, 100%. And hers was, according to this guy, at least in our relative era, impossible
sure,
to
sure.
do.
I'm just
versus
saying
Steve
no
Jobs one, is like, no,
listen,
we can do it.
I'm not saying you should do this. I'm just saying this is.
Yeah.
No one goes back in time after finding that out and fines you or penalizes you or yells at you or
same
depresses
thing with
your stock
Mac,
price.
Dude, who acted like he knew what he was going to do and then like didn't know he was going to lose all of the fights to Dustin. like wait a second. You're not, you don't really know what's going to happen. Yeah. It's no, you do definitely in the world of, if you're trying to make it business-wise, sports-wise, whatever, to act better than you are is a very good idea.
Well, it works. I don't know if it's a good idea. I don't know if I want people. I don't know if I want people doing this, but it is effective.
It will get you more sales, more coverage, more money to act better than you are. Because when you're not good, you fade into obscurity, and there's almost no price to be paid for it. You just lose like all the other losers who didn't act. But on the rare occasions that you pull it off, and sometimes it gets more juice to you and more attention, you know, he psyched Dustin out the first time. Like, I do really think that that first fight, Dustin versus Connor, Connor was probably the better fighter, but he also got in his head and freaked him out. And I think he did that with a lot of it. Like, Eddie Alvarez is a wrestler who just got in there and didn't try to wrestle him. He was just lost.
Yeah, while his coaches begged him to wrestle.
Jose Aldo was, like he looked... I honest to God, Connor's mental game, I think, was a huge component of some of those early wins. And yeah, so it just helps early on. And then when you break your leg and you don't predict it, it's like, yeah, of course he couldn't know that. He's still.
Well, I guess my only takeaway is that Theranos CEO clearly idolized Steve Jobs. She wore the turtlenecks in his
honor. Yeah, and tried to be him.
And her lying about her product was just another way that she was emulating her hero. Like that, she just took it from his playbook, which is your product's not ready. Say it is.
Yeah.
I just thought that was really interesting. I didn't know that.
Maybe Steve had a plan to just yell at his employees really hard until
maybe she had a plan to yell at her employees till they did it.
Cool.
Yeah. Don't have a takeaway. Not saying you should do it at all. I just thought it was interesting that that's the birth of the iPhone. It was just a magic show, basically, and a product that didn't work.
Cool. Let's do some questions.
Cool. I got one. So often in your conversations.
Well, one question.
Yeah. Often in your conversations, I hear a sense of uncertainty. You often finish thoughts with the phrase, but I don't know for sure, or I'm not 100% certain. I think this is a very humble and important trait. However, how do you reconcile this with the usual advice that is given to young people entering the workforce? We're told to seem confident and speak with certainty and authority so that we'll be taken seriously, and often those who do this see results and climb the ladder faster. If you always speak with uncertainty, you might not be taken seriously when you have a good idea, or you might not be seen as deserving of a promotion with more responsibility. Mm-hmm. This is akin to fake it till you make it mentality.
Oh, I'm on air and being recorded. I have way more conviction when I'm not on the podcast. This is because it's being consumed by thousands of people and I don't know everybody's belief system. And so I have to couch what I'm saying in a way that is hopefully understood by the most amount of people. And I know that people are just going to clip this and try to make it something that isn't being said. So I'm trying to speak in a way that is understandable to everybody on the planet and gives the devil his due in every regard. Mm-hmm. When I'm just talking to people, I don't talk like that. It's a very different tone and much less of a cover your ass mentality. And it's much more about just what I believe in. Mm-hmm. This is my podcast. Persuasion is very different from my in-person persuasion.
Well, and also if we wanted to grow the podcast, wouldn't be so nuanced. I wouldn't be the first thing I did. I'd probably get some guests, but somewhere on that list is stop hedging. Just go give crazy hot takes. Sure. That's what people want. Is not want. That's what people click.
Well, you know,
that's
actually,
what people react and respond to in the short term.
Yes, but here's the problem. We're kind of all over the place. So even our hot takes, like the one, let's say most people identify with a political party, and so they're Democrat down the line, and then other people are Republican, but they have their identity. We might just come out with an aggressive take on abortion in one direction and gun control in the other that people loved but then hated. And mm-hmm. I don't think that's how you build an audience. I think how you build an audience is you just pick a side and then you go down the fairway with hot takes that they're going to love. And you just say, I'm going to have half the people hate me. I'm going to have half the people love me. And that's a big audience, half the people. And we would, I think, be constantly like upsetting the people that we had just brought in as fans when we switched which side of the aisle we were in favor of.
Yeah.
So I don't think we would grow just by being more hot takey, because our hot takes don't go straight down the fairway.
So in any event, you're like, what do I do in my job? How do I handle
this? Don't hedge like we do as much on the podcast.
Definitely less than we do on the podcast, but I'm not sure it's not going to be great. The other thing is that we're speaking on topics like the economy and politics, which I don't spend most of my time looking and reading. The things that I am least hedgy on are the philosophical grounds, which I feel like I have explored this. So hopefully in your job, when you're speaking about something, you have a degree of mastery over it, which leads you to be much more comfortable finishing sentences strongly.
But I can also tailor, like we had the height thing, and you're like, well, don't forget about people who are born without faces. I'm like, that's a fair point when I don't know who I'm talking to.
Yeah.
But if I'm talking to someone at dinner, I'm looking at you. If you have a face, I don't have to throw that out there. I can just say, listen, you have a victim mentality. You think this is out of your control.
Yeah.
You get in good shape, change your haircut, change your style, and be much more attractive. Like, I can speak to an individual.
Because you understand where they're coming from, their assumptions, their background, and you don't have to clarify for some amorphous audience who could technically be anybody and might go, I have no face.
Which is fair. Like, that's a great point. If I were talking to someone who didn't have a face, I would not tell them that height was the most important thing. I'd be like, dude, yours is a really, really rough spot. This is going to be a game plan I've never come up with for how to improve your dating life. Mm-hmm. But most of your conversations, you know who you're talking to, so you can afford to be specific and you can afford to make certain shared reality assumptions that we cannot.
In sum, don't emulate how we do it on the podcast.
No.
I would instead look at how I do it on the YouTube channel. Like, look at how some of my these are presentations. If you look at any talking head video I have, I might talk about a couple edge cases, but
you should do this.
Cover in the same. I tell people what to do. And are there exceptions to those rules? Yes, there are. And some of them come up in the comments and go, not in this situation. But I go, this is supposed to be instructive. I've thought about this. This covers most of the cases. Here's a handful of the exceptions. Like, take a look at my talking heads for how you ought to speak, present, all that kind of stuff.
And also, I think even at work, when you are trying to, let's say you don't know all the details, I think you can still with conviction just say, you know, I have to dive deeper into the data, but here's my hypothesis. I think that we could grow tremendously if we did X, Y, Z. Mm-hmm. It's like, I would have to dive deeper in the data, but I did a cursory cut this morning, and I think this is a bad plan because based on what I saw, the real growth lever is this, and doing this is only going to grow 5%. Like, you can still couch it with the fact that you're not 100% sure, but ending, this is actually something interesting that I don't know if people have heard before. What you end the sentence on is the thing that sticks. So if you say, I have to dig into the data more because I'm not 100% sure, but from what I looked at in the data, I think our biggest growth lever is this, and that's where we should focus, is going to come off much more compelling and commanding and certain than, I dug into the data and what I think we should do to grow is this, but I haven't done a full analysis and I'm not 100% sure. Yeah. The last part, when you have a two-clause sentence.
When you have a but sentence. You have a but sentence.
Okay, sure. What you end with is what sticks. Mm-hmm. And so that's a way to express uncertainty, but still have conviction. That plus your tone. And in that way, you can express what might be true, which is, I don't know 100% yet. I haven't fully done the math, but still come across well.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful.
Cool. Let's do Patreon.
Patreon. Appreciate all you guys for watching. If you want to hop over to Patreon, we got a bunch more questions. What are we talking about today?
We're going to answer how to be a great wingman, if sweatshops could be good, and then something of a nightlife 101 guide.
Oh, nice.
That's
an area of expertise where I will be certain. So if you want to check that out, it's $3, gets you access, keeps the podcast going, money in Justin's pocket, and a microphone in front of our faces. So we hope that you guys decide to do that either way. We appreciate you. Take care.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.